It's interesting that right now, artificial intelligence is really dominating the headlines. Society, once again, is awestruck and surprised that machines, mechana, can simulate intelligence. It can come off like magic inside of a box, a ghost in a machine, automation that feels alive. And that got me thinking, was there ever an analog artificial intelligence, a mechina intelligence, as it were? Now, of course, I'm a technologist, and I love all things Ada Lovelace and the analytical engine, but I wanted to go back even further, and that is the ancient world of automata, machines that can act like or can simulate what a human or an animal could do. Yet they are completely mechanical. A mechanical bird that can sing, bears that can blow bubbles, human automatas that can write on paper while sitting at a desk. These were all once mechanical living things, powered by gears and springs. And many of the concepts that constructed those automata are closely adjacent to the art and science of horology. That art and science starting in ancient history and becoming a life of their own in the Renaissance. But how is the ancient world, the automata of the Renaissance, and horology today all linked? The answer? An antiquarian horologist and a friend of ours in the Watch Fam. You've tuned into the Analog Explorer podcast. Read about my analog manifesto, my passion for photography, and my love of travel, diving, and watches in print or online at analogexplorer.com. Today's guest is Brittany Nicole Cox, or Nico for short. Located right here in Washington State on Vashon Island, she is the owner and proprietor of Memoria Technica. She is an antiquarian horologist who specializes in the conservation and restoration of antique automata. But not only that, she also works on mechanical musical objects, complicated clocks and watches, and singing bird objects. More on that later. If there ever was an analog artificial intelligence, then Nico's specialized craft in horology with automata, I think that's probably the closest thing that I'll find. What did civilizations hundreds of years ago think when these technological artisans created this mechana intelligence? And better yet, in today's horology, is there a place still for mechanical automata? Nico, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I found out about your work in probably the most random way ever. I was a brand new dad, and my wife and I were up because baby was up. We had the YouTube on, and we're trying to coo him and put him down. And we were watching this YouTube channel called Great Big Story. And poof, you show up in Seattle, Washington. And it said horology in the title. And I was like, what? Seattle? What? Horologist? What? And I watched your story there, and I was like, who is this? This is amazing. You work on automata.
Yes, Leah. My favorites are singing bird automata, but I work on all kinds of automata. So those that are in watches, figures like bears that blow bubbles or play the cello, magicians that perform tricks and hats, just all kinds of things like that. Anything that really fits that bill of, you know, kind of simulating a living act or a living form.
That's amazing. So how does one become an antiquarian horologist? Like, how did you find yourself going, I really like automata?
Oh, well, you know, that's kind of a long story. I started as a child. I collected music boxes and watches and clocks and, well, anything mechanical, really, anything that followed a set of rules. And I just loved things like that. They were very special to me. So as I got older, you know, it wasn't a thing you grow up and, you know, when you take that test in high school, when they're like, you're going to be a, you know, you're going to work in a doctor's office. Like, I got florist and car mechanic and fishing boat captain were like the three jobs that I got. Yeah, it wasn't watchmaker, horologist. Those were not activities that were, you know, given back as possible career choices. So I didn't really know that that's what I wanted to do or what I could do. And so I worked as a jeweler and I trained as a jeweler, but then I went to college and I started out in engineering, which is what my dad does. But, you know, to be honest, I'm not great at arithmetic. Like, I find complicated maths, like abstract maths, pretty difficult. And I think a lot of people are surprised to hear that. But it's really like the tactile math that I understand because I can see how these systems work. So you know, engineering, as far as doing all of these big calculations and stuff, that really just wasn't for me. So, and I'm also pretty logical. So I ended up studying philosophy and I got a degree in the physics and epistemology, which is the theory of knowledge and possibility, really. And in these studies, I had learned about these incredible mechanical objects called automata that were made in the Renaissance period as and the Enlightenment as ways of looking at bigger philosophical questions, but through a tactile and tangible application. And so I found that just absolutely fascinating and decided that I wanted to work with those objects and I wanted to look at philosophical questions by actually making those objects and studying them. So I found out about watchmaking school and enrolled in that program, and the rest is kind of history.
Oh, crazy. So which watchmaking school did you go through? Seattle's or somewhere else?
I had learned about, you know, the WOSTAT program in Switzerland. I had reached out to actually see if I could study abroad, which would have been amazing. But, you know, I don't know if this is still the case, but at the time, if you were able to go to a school in your country, you know, you were really urged to do that. And you could, you know, try to apply to go to further education programs once you got your WOSTAT. So I decided to apply to the Seattle school because I had been here when I was a kid and I love the outdoors. So I'm big into like hiking and, you know, climbing and mountaineering and stuff. And this was like the perfect place for me to be for that, you know, and then to be able to study what I wanted to study here was amazing. So I applied to the watchmaking school here and I got in and, you know, it wasn't exactly what I was looking for because it really focused on modern watches and machinery, you know, and with WOSTEP, we still got to make a lot of parts and we did our student watch and, you know, made bridges and, you know, ballad staff and hairspring and a lot of things that I don't know that you get the opportunity to make as much anymore. But when I was in it, I was lucky and got to do that. But I wanted a lot more than that. You know, I wanted to cut wheels and I wanted to be able to make things from scratch. So I enrolled in an 18th century clock making program in England that I had found when I was in school. Yeah, in the watchmaking program. So after I graduated watchmaking, I did another degree in 18th century clock making.
When you were studying here in Seattle, like, because we've had Elena on the show before, was there anybody in your cohort of watchmakers that you kind of stay in touch with, or was there anybody else in the group that was also equally in quirkiness with you? If it's like, I want to go even further back than this modern junk, like.
No, not really. Not in that respect. Like, I do have people I keep in touch with, a few from the program. And I've made a lot of friends, you know, that went through the program after me, Elena being one of them. But no, I was kind of the weird kid. I like brought in an old musical typewriter that I was trying to restore. And everybody was like, what is this lady doing?
Awesome.
just fun stuff like that for me. You know, we had this great workshop. So we had, you know, a lot of tools I didn't have access to otherwise. So, you know, why not take advantage of that? It's not like there was a rule that I couldn't bring in weird stuff, but there weren't people that were like diving in with me on these projects. But now I do have some, like my friend Reg, who was my bench partner in school, we're still in touch. And, you know, he actually moved back out here recently. He ended up coming with me to handle this big estate where I got most of my equipment. Out in Connecticut. So Rhett and I went through a 5,000 square foot building of rare antique machinery and dealt with that over the course of 7 months of our lives. And he ended up staying out there and just came back. So anyhow, Rhett, yeah, and that was like, God, almost 10 years ago now. So
whoa.
Nice to have Reg back on the West Coast.
I agree. Reg, you are the goods. So riddle me this. So like you to repair any of this stuff, like I've talked to other horologists where, like, you know, obviously it's common to have different machines to mill things out and stuff. For you, like a lot of these automata that I've seen bits of you work on and stuff, you're in most cases reinventing the wheel in some of these things. Like there's a bird that I've seen you reference several times where like you refeathered it and stuff. Like when you get a piece, like either it's commissioned or you source it, or however you go about it, like what goes on in you restoring it or rejuvenating it? Like what do you qual that? Because like in some cases, it looks like you're starting with a blank slate or a blank automata. I don't know what else to call it.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes, I have to make birds from scratch completely. So start from nothing. The bird is missing altogether. And then that does include, you know, cutting out the gearing for the inside or the lever system for however it works, depending on what size or type of bird that it is, because different mechanisms have different types of birds in them. And then it's, yeah, there's the art of refeathering completely, which is very, very time consuming. You know, I would say that from start to finish, it's probably about 15 hours because each feather is selected for its shape and its color, and it's prepared. So, you know, you don't just take a feather as it is and plop it on there. You have to dress the feather first. And, you know, if you imagine how many feathers a bird has, you know, you want this to be as lifelike as possible. So these feathers are layered and they're very carefully put on the body, and the size is considered and the way that the feather is placed so that it doesn't interrupt the course of the movement of the automaton. So like you can't put them so that the head doesn't move or the wings get arrested somewhere. So yeah, there's a lot of work that goes into that. But of course, my hope is to try to base anything that I do on historical reference or precedence, especially, you know, if this is a sensitive object that really needs to be, that all needs to really be considered. You know, if you have something where everything is missing, you really, it's almost like a blank check. You can just kind of come up with something, and that can be super fun, you know, if the client is excited about that. But often, you know, people really do want these things to present as they would have, you know, when they were first made. But obviously with conservation, that's a very difficult line to toe because you don't want to restore something completely so it looks new. It really needs to keep the, you know, that historical integrity of the object so that it does carry on its lineage and its story as an object throughout time.
Yeah, that's what I'd always wondered, because obviously these pieces, up until I saw, you know, your work, I didn't even know that automata was still a craft that was still there. Here's my question. Like, how many antiquarian horologists do you know? Like, how many of you are there out there still?
That's a good question. I think that's a hard question to answer, because I think there are a lot of people that fit very specific niches within the field. You know, I have friends that are just really amazing clock restorers. You know, that's what they do. They specialize maybe in like 18th century long case clocks. And then there are people that specialize in American clocks. And then there are people that are, you know, just watch restorers, and that's what they do. And they specialize in a specific type of pocket watch or certain, you know, period of pocket watch. And, you know, and so they're all antiquarian horologists, I would say. But, you know, my specific of being an automaton person, I also have a degree in conservation, a museum studies degree in dynamic objects, specifically clock and watch and horological objects. And I'm also a certified watch and clockmaker separately from that. That's quite a niche. I don't actually know that there's anyone quite like me that fits that exact, you know, that type of study. I was in school for over 9 years. So it's something I've treated like, you know, being a surgeon or a doctor. I've taken that seriously, and it's not something that I feel like I'm done learning either. You know, I definitely still learn from people that are specialists. Like, I have a friend who, you know, he just makes singing bird boxes, and he is amazing. His name is Ibram Shargorodsky, and he was a jeweler. He never went through any specific training, but is just amazing. Like, there are things that I've know only because Ibram spent, you know, the last 20 years devoting his life to just deciding to do this crazy thing. I'm so fortunate that I have someone like that, you know, is such a dear friend that I can, you know, ask for advice sometimes. And I mean, same with me, you know, he'll call me for something too. Even if you're a specialist in something, like, you certainly still want to call upon people that may have a bit more experience in this or that, or you'd have seen something that you've never seen before, because that happens with this old stuff.
And as an academic, I completely understand, like, the learning process never stops with a degree. If you're a lifelong learner, you're always working on either your craft or your skill or your trade. I completely agree. The reason why I was asking how many of you or like you there is because you're often really well cited. Like, you're in several different documentaries. I think you were even in like Vanity Fair, like you were written about in Vanity Fair and stuff. Everybody always kind of points to you as like the pinnacle of when it comes to automata, like, talk to Nico. And I was just wondering, when it comes to like restoring stuff, what happens when you get stumped? Like, you get a piece and you're like, I really don't know what to do with this. Like, what does that happen at all? Because this is old stuff. Like,
I mean, it does. Like, I've got a piece that, you know, I've had in my shop for a few years now. And I mean, it was something I got before the pandemic, but then, you know, that happened. And then I moved my shop, and it's, you know, that's one reason I've had it for a couple of years. But it's like, the issue that I have with it is that it's one of three. And the other two, there's no documentation of what that should look like. Yeah. You know, I know what it should do because I have seen a video, but it's not like any other mechanism I've seen. Hmm. So there's stuff missing. So what's there, you know, is not telling me, I know what it's supposed to do, but what's there doesn't do that. So I'm in the unique position of figuring out, oh, okay. So I either can do, you know, try to reach out to possible resources to figure out, you know, what exactly this is supposed to be. And hopefully someone will be kind enough to share some information or photos even of exactly what's supposed to be there. It's not that I can't figure it out, but it's that, you know, first of all, it's the time involved in figuring it out. Right. There's a lot there. You know, there's the research and design, and, you know, and that is really where people end up investing a lot of money in getting something fixed. Because if you don't have a reference, it's not like I can just go and figure it out, you know, by looking exactly at what is supposed to be there. I have to reverse engineer this. Hmm. And it's not like one part, you know, it's not like there's a clue exactly like where there's an imprint of what would have been there. Like, no, there, a lot of stuff is missing. And so that can be a real problem. And unfortunately, I don't, you know, I can't turn to someone else in this case that has worked on one of these. I don't, you know, the other ones that are out there, I don't know who worked on them, or, you know, I don't know what they needed, if anything, to be worked on, or if the person even took any records of actually what's there.
Right.
So, I mean, in that case, all I can do is, you know, maybe call my friend Ephraim and say, hey, you know, what? This is a wacky thing. Like, what do you think? And he's going to be in a very similar boat to me, you know, and we maybe just clunk our heads together for a while until we come up with a solution. Or, you know, maybe that's just me in my shop staring at it for way too long. I don't know.
So do you work with museums at all? Because, I mean, you've got to, like, have all of this body of knowledge and stuff, and stuff that is in a museum. I feel like Indiana Jones, it's got to be in a museum. That stuff has to be worked on to be preserved, I'm presuming, right?
Yeah. I mean, I do work with museums. You know, I'm just actually going to be working on a big project for the Toledo Museum of Art, which I'm super excited about. I don't yet have clearance to talk about it. We'll see. Okay. I mean, I hope I can share that, because it's going to be, I know that it'll be shared when it's on view, when it's finished, but I'm hoping maybe they'll let me share and talk about what I'm doing before that. But we'll see. It is a big project, but it's super exciting. And one of the things I worked on for them before was a small singing bird box that was part of an exhibition on birds that was called Wondrous Bird, because the Toledo Museum is actually right in a migratory bird path where all these birders from all over the world go to this place, Toledo, to look at birds. And it's so cool. I don't know how I know that, because I'm an absolute bird fanatic. But yeah, apparently it's one of the most wonderful birding destinations there is. So the museum will host kind of a celebratory acknowledgement of birds and put on exhibitions specifically for birds. So I was lucky and could work on a beautiful piece for one of their shows there.
Holy Toledo, that's cool. I've been waiting this whole time to say that.
Well timed.
Thank you. I try. So you're an avid aviary enthusiast, it sounds like. So what?
Oh, goodness. Yes.
One, I got to know, what is your favorite bird? And two, what is your favorite bird-related horological device then?
Oh, no. Okay. Well, that is too difficult to say. I mean, a favorite bird is so hard to say. There's so many wild birds out there, and their behaviors are so strange. Like, varies can predict hurricanes better than we can with any analytical software. Like, crazy math might be able to kind of describe the murmuration of starling flocks. Mm-hmm. A set of goldfinches is called a charm, like a group. Like, how do you pick? I don't know. I love yellow-headed blackbirds.
Oh, right on.
So much, maybe. I don't know if I could say that they're my favorite, but hummingbirds might be, because they're just so beautiful and jewel feathered and so funny. They have such interesting personalities. Oh my gosh, they're bossy and grumpy and all kinds of things. So I don't know, that's so hard to say, but I implore everyone to look further into the avian world of illumination out there. It's unreal. My favorite bird automaton would definitely be the silver swan automaton, because it is just absolutely incredible. And it's hard to say that there's anything to kind of really marvel that in the ingenuity and engineering that happened with that object. And it's also what brought me into the field specifically, was learning about that.
That's cool. And did you work on that piece?
I did. I mean, not extensively, I want to say. You know, I was very fortunate that my tutor at Westin College, he had been the restorer, the conservator that worked on it and got it working again. So I specifically, one of the reasons I enrolled in the program was because he would be my tutor, and I really wanted to learn under Matthew Reed. And Matthew would set it up so that, because he knew how special this was to me, he set up on a study tour for me to be able to actually go and do some routine maintenance with him. So that was just, you know, so amazing for me, even though it was, you know, pretty minor. It was just dealing with, there was some issue with the chains that move the little fish underneath. They're basically like little fusy chains that these fish are on. There was just some friction going on in there. So, you know, we got in there and did some lubrication and, you know, very small adjustments of them and got the fish working again. But it was great. It was just so amazing to be able to even just take a small part in the lineage of caring for that object.
But on that note, I've got to ask, your sweet spot's probably like 17th, 18th century level of stuff. Do you see any like resurgence of that? Like back in those days, like automata was like a style of artistic expression and like storytelling. And do you see any of that today? Are we going to see more automata, like outside of going to the Penny Museum and getting Zoltron giving you like a thing that says, here is your wish? You know, like what do you see as the new age of automata?
Oh, golly. I mean, I think there are people definitely that are interested in this. I mean, Van Cleef and Arpels create a lot of beautiful automata, like watches and figures and things. And Francois Junot is just an automaton maker in Switzerland. And Miguel Alita is an incredible, like, a horologist that also puts automata in all of his incredible clocks. So, I mean, I definitely think there's a resurgence of automata. You know, it's definitely kind of a niche, you know, where it's not as useful as a watch, and it's not as easy to pull out of your pocket to impress your friends, or, you know, you're not sitting around at your fancy party drinking whiskey and being like, oh, look at my Patek Philippe or my Philippe Dufour, you know, it's not like that. But I mean, who knows? I hope maybe I want to make a singing bird in a locket someday. So maybe that'll happen. Where it'll come back, I don't know. But they are coming back, I think. And it's really exciting to see, because these objects just are so special. And the way that they, as you said, storytelling, like the way that they tell a story is just so different than pretty much any other object, I think.
If you did that, if you did a bird that would sing out of a locket, my son is basically growing up to be either an adventurer or a ornithologist. He's loved birds since... well, we were blurry-eyed and he was breastfeeding. Like we would throw on like the Cornell School of Ornithology has a great YouTube channel of bird calls. By the time he was like 2, he could do like pitch perfect loon calls. That's how nerdy my kid is.
Wow.
Yeah. So if you did that, my son would probably be like, oh, that's your heart song. Cause that's what he always calls like anything that makes him happy is your heart sings. So like if you had a locket that would sing, it's a heart song. Oh. There you go.
That's really sweet. Love that.
So let's one other question I got about automata and storytelling in clock and in watchmaking. Like there are watches and clock, like when I think an automata clock that anybody can relate to, like a cuckoo clock, like a cuckoo comes out and sings the time. Yeah. And stuff. How do you get a thing that's supposed to live and breathe like a bird? What mechanically makes it go like how does that work?
It's just a set of bellows. So kind of similar to a fireplace bellow, you know, you expand it and it brings in air and you compress it and the air leaves. In this case, it leaves through a slide whistle. So, you know, it's just like for when you had when you were a kid, that type thing. And then there's a valve that opens and closes. And so you can get basically a very clearly articulated bird song just using something quite simple.
That's cool. So it's basically little toy whistles on barrel springs is what
fine.
You're saying.
Slightly more refined.
Well, yes. Okay. Yes. I know. I'm a podcaster. I'm not a horologist, but like, you know, that's crazy to think that's how they came up with that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of bringing it forward a little bit more. You mentioned that you do guilloche, and that requires like a rose engine and I'm guessing some other dark arts. Because I know through Elena, Elena. So like full disclosure, like I know like you were doing like a workshop, and it sounds like, do you do workshops on guilloche? Like why guilloche, and how does that dovetail into automata, or does it?
Oh, it definitely does. It's a very long long story. I might be able to kind of shrink it down a bit, at least how they are related. They are part of the same archetypal knowledge set. So if you look at, if you going all the way back to Greek and you go through the classics, the seven classic liberal arts, there's two sections to that.
So I want to push pause for a second because Nico said something that was academically important, and that is the notion of the seven classical liberal arts. Now, in today's day and age, when you hear a liberal arts college or a liberal arts university, they share in history, but you may not have the same notion of what we're saying as the classical liberal arts. When we're talking about automata, we're going way back. It's part of ancient history. That's right. Ancient history, cogs and springs, things coming to life. Really skookum. And that is where we see the heart of horology. So back in ancient Greece and Rome, they divided education into two categories, the trivium and the quadrivium. Now, trivium, tri, meaning three, consisted of grammar, logic, and rhetoric. Basically, the study of communications, reasoning, and language. On the other hand, you had the more divine subjects, or the divine truths of subjects, and that was the quadrivium. That was arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. Keep that in mind as we talk about guilloche, or engine turning, or ornamental turning, and when we look at time and space, because in and around the quadrivium, for us in the Watch Fam, this is also where we discover horology.
You've got your basic foundational section, which is grammar, rhetoric, logic. And then you've got your other set, which was considered divine subjects because they dealt with absolute truths, basically. Like they dealt with math mostly. So goodness, you've got the study of numbers. You've got the, so arithmetic, you've got the study of numbers in time. That would be music. You've got geometry, which is the study of numbers in space, and then you've got astronomy, the study of numbers in space and time. So horology is a child of astronomy, and ornamental turning, or guilloche, is a study of, is a branch of geometry. So you've got these two pieces coming down from the same archetypal knowledge, which was used as the foundation for education in all of Europe. Basically all, you know, we've got the Holy Roman Empire there. Basically it's this incredible lineage where these two subjects parallel, coming through from this early knowledge that was the foundation of basically everything we know today. You know, if you look back, the seven liberal arts, these are still what we are taught in university. And so ornamental turning, which is where engine turning comes from, was the practice of kings, and it was their way of communing with God to basically, you know, divine... Through the use of the lathe and implementing mathematical principles and sequences and program to produce these incredible objects. This was their communion with God that proved that they were rulers worthy of their position in the court. So they made these wild objects. If you look them up there, you can Google the Coburg ivories. I believe they're in the Pitti Palace Museum in Florence, Italy still, but they were part of the... this war, and there were 30 of them originally. I think there are 27 left now, but they're all made of ivory. They're, you know, maybe about 4 feet tall or so, and they took a king anywhere from 12 to 16 months or something like that to make just one. And the same type of turning used to make those ended up being kind of taken by craftsmen to create objects for kings. So the craft transitioned from things made by kings to things made for kings. And it ended up being utilized by Breguet that put it on watches, Fabergé that put them on objects of art, so those beautiful eggs for the Tsar, Nicholas II, and also onto the cases of automata. And so we get this convergence that starts to happen. And, you know, automata being a branch of horology, basically, and also something that was utilized in the pleasure gardens of the Greeks. You know, they have the famous story of the owl and these birds that were hydraulically powered with fountains and things that were in their, you know, beautiful garden of wonders, and the seven, I believe, like the original, the seven ancient wonders of the world. Yeah, I mean, that. So they're all just part of this strange story where it all goes together, and it's pretty interesting. And I just happen to be, you know, pretty smitten and fascinated with the whole thing. And yeah, I teach. So Elena took one of my guilloche workshops. I, and hold workshops on the art of guilloche. So students come in and they learn how to use the Rose Engine and the straight line machine. And I offer that in, you know, a few different levels. So we start with beginners, we can move to intermediate where we make objects, and advanced people can make things like dials. And I just recently started getting set up to do enameling. So I'm excited to host my first enameling class, and I'm bringing in a tutor who's amazing to come and teach that with me this summer.
So to dovetail back to like the notion of the kings and communing with God and geometry creation as a form of sacredness, is that some of the lineage behind the title of that coloring book that you co-authored with somebody else? Wasn't it titled The Sacred Geometry? And on like, isn't that have guilloche, like are all those coloring pages just different guilloche program plates? I don't know what you call it on the Rose Engine.
They're patterns that were generated by the rosettes on an ornamental lane, actually. So they're the same. If you look at them, they're the same patterns that you'll find on, you know, watch cases and dials and stuff. But the reason we had to use the ornamental lathe to do it is that the amplitude of the rosettes are much higher. So that gives you these voids that you can color in. Otherwise, you know, the lines would be so close together, you wouldn't be able to see to color in any of the spaces. So, that's really the difference between ornamental turning and engine turning, is that the amplitudes of the rosettes are exaggerated, you know, for objects, three-dimensional shapes, you know, on the ornamental lathe. And then the Rose Engine, it's meant for engraving. So everything's supposed to be very fine and, you know, delicate and cut very close together.
So to kind of dovetail this into watches and horology in the more contemporary sense, I notice as you're talking, you must be part Italian like I am, because I if you hold my hands, I won't be able to talk, even as a podcaster. But I notice you're not wearing a watch. So what does the antiquarian horologist typically wear to tell time? I'm curious.
Oh, you know, that's kind of funny. I don't, as silly as that is, I don't look, look at the time very often. You know, I mean, I do, because I'm, you know, maybe I'm working on a clock and I'm obsessed with the timekeeping qualities, really. So I'd say, you know, the timekeeping devices are usually the ones that I'm working on. And, you know, maybe I'll check that against my iPhone or something. But
sure.
Yeah. I mean, I do have a couple of watches that I love, but I save them really for special occasions. And so I have a Breitling. It's a Breitling Cosmonaut.
This
is the 24-hour version of the Navitimer. And this was something that, it was actually the first watch I purchased. But yeah, so that watch is pretty precious to me. And that is something that I always pull out for special occasions. I mean, I guess it's so precious, I don't wear it every day. So, you know, if I have an everyday watch, that's, you know, maybe my Casio. It's just a little, you know, $10 Casio from the thrift store. And that's just simple. And I, you know, because otherwise it's just kind of big. I'm in the workshop banging around, you know, I don't want to, you know, if I'm having to machine something, I'm working on a milling machine or I'm working on the Rose Engine, I don't want to break a crystal or scratch it or, you know, it's
right.
Yeah. I go with the cheap plastic stuff, but hey, that stuff keeps good time.
No, I completely agree. I mean, I ride motorcycle and I'm constantly working on it or my truck or stuff. And on those times, yeah, I'll take my watch off, because like to get your hand through a manifold, I've burned the inside of my forearm too many times on manifolds that I can count. So like, yeah, I totally understand not having to wear it. So like when you're working within something, I mean, whether it's an engine or in your case, like in something mechanical, like you don't want to have to break your concentration just because you rammed your crystal into something or whatnot.
I guess that's, yeah, it's something where I really just try to be present with the day and watch, you know, the movement of the sun. I usually know by my stomach what time the afternoon is, as long as I get hungry I'm pretty boring in that way. I'm always hungry at the same times, but that seems to be a good internal clock.
So I'm getting the vibe from you that you're a lot like me. You're very connected to the outdoors and stuff, because like I'm the same way. Like if I'm up in the mountains, you know, like I will be up at the dawn chorus and I'll go to sleep when I'm dog tired and I've put in 20 miles. Like, so I'm kind of curious, like, do you have any sundials or anything like natural timekeeping that you keep around that, you know, syncs up with you? Or is that type of stuff like way out, like it's pre-automata? It doesn't move. I don't care. Like, is there anything natural timekeeping that's in your wheelhouse?
Oh, I mean, I have a tiny pocket sundial, but it's not set up for my actual, you know, it's got to be for where you live. geographically your coordinates and those are really work. But I just keep it a novelty and I'll take it out with me, you know, maybe if I'm hiking or something, I'll pull out my little pocket Neumann. But it's not, you know, it'd be cool to make one specifically for where I live. Maybe that's a good idea. Something I could just put in and go and just say, oh, well, you know, it's my watch right here.
Yeah. Yeah. The Cascadian edition, you know, that'd be kind of cool as a tribute to our area. So speaking of our neck of the woods, if people wanted to find you or be like, yo, I'm around Seattle, I want to learn how to do guilloche and all this really cool automata stuff, how do they go about finding out about that?
Oh, people can look me up online. My website is mechanicalcurios.com. My business is Memoria Technica. My Instagram is Nico Curio. So just drop me a line, fill out a form or send me a message and let me know you want to take class. I'd love to have you.
To kind of wrap up, every time I have somebody on the show, I usually ask the question, why watches? But for you, I kind of want to deviate from that because you do so much more than just horology. So like, I guess my question really is why Mechina, especially because being that Memoria Technica is your workshop and your ethos.
Yeah.
Why Technica? Why do you resonate with that so much?
Oh gosh. I mean, I guess because it is me. I feel like it's the one thing that I really truly understand. It's, you know, and I feel like that's, there's so many things in the world that don't make a lot of sense. You know, you can spend your life really trying to understand a lot of things that you just will never have the answers to. And there's something really comforting to me about just, you know, being able to have this device and look at it and understand it and know the purpose, the intention of it. And that intention, at least with the things that I work with, is one of just, it's just of goodness. It's good. You know, it's something that was made to bring joy and to make people happy and to look at big questions, to, you know, really explore these reasons as to why we are here. And that, I mean, what more beautiful thing could I ask for? And I mean, it's not an illusion. It took so much work for someone to make these things. It was such a labor and it, you know, the dedication, the craft, the skill, it's immense, you know, and I think about all these tools we have now to create automata or, you know, complicated mechanisms. People have to sit down and draw that stuff in CAD. They didn't have that. You know, these people have half the resources and yet they were able to make these amazing things. And I just couldn't even imagine trying to make something like a singing bird pistol with over 600 moving parts in it, you know, without something like CAD, because there's systems within systems within systems within systems that all rely on the success of the other to time out perfectly so it works and you get the intended result. And I just think, holy moly, it's just, it's humbling, it's astounding, and it makes me believe in a better future and a better world to know that those things are there.
Hear, hear. Spoken as a true artisan, I think I could probably talk to you all day, but I know you have a ferry to catch. Nico, thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
It's interesting to think that these devices that were built to simulate life or living things were a thing of artisanship, innovation, imagination, and wonder, maybe even magic when they performed. And parts of it, like guilloche, having ties to divinity and kings. What I find interesting is that back then, the artisanship of making those devices was a craft that was revered. And today, with artificial intelligence, or dare I say digital automata, the feeling and sentiment is a little different. And it leaves me wonder where these explorations will go. Much like Nico, I genuinely do hope that automata has a resurgence, maybe even out of this conversation of artificial intelligence. I'd like to see more mechina intelligence in the world. There's something about it that does feel special when the analog art and craftsmanship feels alive. And on that note, we're going to wrap up this mechanical edition of The Analog Explorer. Thank you again so much for listening, rating, reviewing, and subscribing to The Analog Explorer, whether it's in your favorite podcast app of choice or on Substack at analogexplorer.com. Be sure to go there and check out the show notes as well as the links. You will want to see some of these automata that we talked about in the show. My special, super, uber, mechanical thanks to Nico. You can find her online at Nico Curio on Instagram. Her studio, Memoria Technica. Her website is mechanicalcurios.com. And there, you can check out not just where she's been published, anything from Hodinkee, Nat Geo, and Atlas Obscura, but also you'll find some photography that showcases some of the automata that she's worked on, both big and small. And I mean Heart Song small. No matter how big or small or how old it is, if you have an automata or something that falls within her wheelhouse, be sure to check out the services side of her page to see if this antiquarian horologist might be able to bring an heirloom of yours back to life. I'm AJ Barce, your analog explorer, reminding you to make the time to explore.